Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Blake Murphy. And the Major League Baseball winter meetings are happening right now in San Diego. And it's the first time in years and years that this has been an in-person, normal-ish winter meetings without, you know, the virtual element of the pandemic, without a looming lockout, without all of it. It's just normal, normal, normal. And early returns are quite good if you're into movement at the winter meetings. And who wouldn't? Who's like, you know, against players moving? Not Blue Jays fans, because they're expecting big things this offseason. Let's talk to our pal, John Morosi, MLB Network in California. Things are happening, John.
It is our kind of winter meetings, my friends. I love it. I'm glad to be back. Very grateful indeed that we've got the winter meetings back for the first time in 3 years, as you described. And yes, anytime your day begins with Verlander and Trey Turner moving, it is a good day indeed.
Yeah, those are some big names. I mean, is it any indication of more to come? Was it unexpected, the fact that both happened on the same day? We saw Jacob deGrom last week. Like, what do you make of this being so active with the big names early on?
Yeah, I think a couple things. Number one, there's a healthy amount of money in the game. You look at the signings. I thought the biggest bellwethers that we had early on in the offseason was the deals that we saw Robert Suarez sign and Rafael Montero, where when you've got non-closer relievers signing for significant dollars, it's going to be a very robust market. And now you've got Trey Turner getting $300 million. You've got Aaron Judge, who's going to go beyond that by everything that I'm hearing. And Justin Verlander able to, I think, piggyback very effectively on what DeGrom got from the standpoint of his AAV, and obviously Verlander a shorter-term deal, but you really have a good faith in what you're going to get from Justin Verlander, and I think that now moves down to the next group, whether it's Carlos Rodon or Kodai Senga signing later, and the next tier of pitching, Chris Bassett, Jameson Taillon. It's a very, very healthy market, and I think for me, Ben and Blake, I was encouraged to see that not everyone was going to be waiting for the big deal for Aaron Judge, that we were going to actually see at least some signings happen before the Judge news, and very, very encouraged by how things have played out so far.
Also encouraging to me, at least, is that a couple of the big moves made so far are teams that don't seem to be super worried about the competitive balance tax. John, do you think we've made maybe a little too much about teams' hesitance to go in there? Or is this just, you know, kind of a special offseason where the Mets are fine being maybe that fourth and highest level of tax-paying team? I know this doesn't quite apply to the Phillies as much. They've got a little wiggle room still. But it does seem like the teams in that kind of top tier and second tier are very willing to keep up with each other on a spending front. That's got to be a good signal for the game.
That's a great point, Blake, and you're exactly right. And this is where it's interesting still to see baseball as the one non-salary cap sport in major North American pro sports, because when you get an owner like Steve Cohen, or like the Giants may end up doing with Judge, or like John Middleton with the Phillies, and him signing Trey Turner to effectively replace Bryce Harper's production for however long he's out, and then certainly long, long beyond then, with Harper, of course, missing the start of the season after Tommy John surgery. It just shows that with the right combination of owners in the right markets, that you can really have an industry overall that shows a lot of health. And I think to make the larger point, Blake, and I'm glad you framed the question that way, you know, we were back here in the late days of 2019, and this was the winter meetings when Strasburg, Rendon, Gerrit Cole, they all got paid. There were some pretty significant deals that were handed out back then. And then the pandemic hit a couple months later, and really only recently has, you know, business and the business of sports begun to feel a bit more normal. And I think that for all the negativity that went along with the work stoppage a year ago, the reality is that when stadiums are full and when spending is more or less normal and revenues are more or less normal, teams are willing to go and pay for premium players. And that's what's happening right now. I think that this is evidence of what we had seen happen towards the end of the quote unquote before times, I would say, in 18 and 19, where teams would spend for premium players. It's the average player who sometimes gets squeezed. But if you're special, If you're Nolan Arenado, if you are Paul Goldschmidt, if you are Mike Trout, if you are Justin Verlander, if you're a special player, you're going to get paid. And that's exactly what's happening already. I think, and I would say, too, the other really important part is that it's been also those setup relievers and maybe more marginal stars who are getting paid a lot of money as well. So I think the last couple of days and indeed the last couple of weeks have really conveyed to me that this is a very, very healthy industry.
All right, so where do the Blue Jays fall in that regard, John? Because we saw reports, Ben Nicholson, Smith reporting that they were willing to go multiple years for Justin Verlander, of course, lose out on that bidding to the Mets, which, you know, it's fine because they've beaten the Mets in a couple of big free agent showdowns over the last couple of years. But do you take that as an indication that they're willing to open the purse strings for a Brandon Nimmo type, or maybe as you've linked them to a Kodai Senga?
Yes, I think the Jays are ready to spend for that. I mean, they would have spent for Verlander, I think, if he was if Toronto was one of his top two choices. I think eventually he made the choice between the Mets and the Dodgers. But I think that for the right player, right price, I do think that the Jays are going to be aggressive, and they have to be. You look around their division and how competitive it is, and the needs that they have. I think the one thing I'll say on the Jays' behalf with their pitching is that there are enough free agent pitchers out there who are good, maybe not great, but good. Like Rodon can be great. The rest of them, I think, are average or above. You know, the Chris Bassetts or Jameson Taillons of the world as well. They're going to get somebody. They will not show up to spring training with this group that they've got right now as their starting five, because they first of all have to replace Ross Stripling if he goes somewhere else. But they also have to acknowledge that what they might get from Ryu and Kikuchi is a wild card. So they're going to get somebody. It's just a question of for whom that will be and how much they have to beat the competition to bring them in. Because obviously there are some players geographically or from Southern California, you may have a preference to play for the Angels. That's something that Jays have to fight against. But then again, the Mariners fight some of the similar battles with respect to where they're located geographically. So I think Toronto is very involved in a lot of different pitching pursuits. I've heard that they're in there on basically every major pitcher. It's just now a question of can they win the bidding? And I think with Nimmo, you're right that they are interested in Nimmo. He fits their team perfectly. Brian Reynolds, by the way, fits their team in a trade perfectly. We'll have to see, obviously, if some other players come over that may fit that description of meeting a lefty outfield bat. But I think Nimmo, they have to really wait and see what happens with Judge. Nimmo is not going to sign before Aaron Judge. He's just not. So I think with respect to Nimmo and the Jays can talk to him a bunch, and I'm sure they already have at length. But he's not going to sign anywhere, I don't think, until Aaron Judge signs.
That makes sense to me, John, and I was actually just about to ask you about that. There's one other trickle-down I could see, and obviously the Jays can't wait until everyone else's shopping is done to do their own. The other thing we've heard at least rumbles of is that, you know, part of their strategy might be in a hold pattern right now, because once a couple of the free agent catchers land, then their leverage might be a little different on the trade front. Have you heard anything on the catcher trade front, or just about what the Jays timeline here looks like? Is it as simple as Judge, or are there more kind of pieces in the air the Jays need the market to set for?
I think the catching thing is huge, Blake. And if I were the Jays, I would try to work very diligently to not wait until Sean Murphy is traded, or wait until Wilson Contreras makes his decision. I'm not sure that the Wilson Contreras free agent market is necessarily as vast in terms of the number of teams that want to spend big on a free agent catcher than we thought it was going to be when the offseason began. I realize rivalries shouldn't necessarily color too much of what you think about a particular free agent, but it's something about that pairing of Contreras to the Cardinals. I don't see it happening. I don't. And so I think that the Jays have a real opportunity to trade Jansen there. I still think he's the most likely of the three to get moved. And to me, it's clear that a deal of Jansen for Lars Nootbaar is one of the scenarios that I think a lot of people in the industry look at and say, this trade makes a lot of sense. It should happen. It would benefit both teams. And the Cardinals, remember, what they can do is they could potentially move. They can get a shortstop. And this is what if I was a Jays fan who was thinking about Jansen going to St. Louis, what I think could happen is you watch the Cardinals sign a shortstop, whether it's Swanson or Bogarts, and then that allows them to have some additional position player depth, and then they trade from that depth. So, for example, if they sign Swanson, they can move Edman back to second and then either trade Donovan to Toronto or move Donovan to the outfield and then trade Nootbaar or Carlson. So that's the kind of a domino effect that I could see. And so if I'm a Jays fan who wants Lars Nootbaar in a trade for Danny Jansen, I would say that you're probably going to cheer for the Cardinals to sign Swanson or Bogarts because they would then have the position player depth to facilitate precisely that kind of a trade.
What about the Brian Reynolds thing? As this is kind of coming to a head because he says he wants to be traded, and who wouldn't? From the Pittsburgh Pirates, and the Pirates, as Blake alluded to earlier in the program, have a first overall selection who's a catcher. So perhaps their need at that position not the same as the St. Louis Cardinals. How robust a market do you expect that to be, and do you expect the Blue Jays to wade into those waters?
I do. I do expect the Jays. Actually, I think they're probably on the short list of the best fits. Because let's remember this, the current head of baseball operations of the Pirates is Ben Cherington, and his assistant GM is Steve Sanders. And where were they right before they were in Pittsburgh? They were in Toronto. And so all those young players that the Jays have in that farm system, especially the upper farm system, Ben and Steve know them. Now, some of those guys have already graduated the big leagues, of course, but that is a system that Steve Sanders and Ben Cherington know as well as any system besides Pittsburgh's. And so it helps if you're going to make a deal to have a really high level of certainty and knowledge about the other side to where you don't really have to worry so much about every last scouting report and every last exit velocity because you know these people. So I think that a Brian Reynolds trade is possible. I don't think it's in any way certain. I want to make clear on what a trade request means in baseball. There's nothing really formal that they can effectively do here from the standpoint of the union. They've asked for there to be a trade. Okay, we can all ask for a lot of things. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. So I think he's made the request through his representation. Fine. And now we have to wait and see how things unfold from there because I do believe that Reynolds – there is probably a little higher chance of a trade happening now than there was 10 days ago or so, just because I think the industry now knows very clearly they're not going to sign him. And there's enough interest. Fortunately for him, there's enough interest, and his price point is palatable enough that I think teams would know what they were getting and what they have to give up to get him. So I do think Brian Reynolds very likely could be moved, and I think the Jays are on the absolute top three or four list of potential suitors for him, in part because of how well Ben Cherington, Steve Sanders, and the overall Pirates infrastructure knows the Jays players.
John, you mentioned the Jays being a possibility for Reynolds, a possibility for Nootbaar. Nootbaar maybe that Jansen trade you mentioned makes a lot of sense as things unfold here. When it comes to Reynolds, you know, about $7 million on the books this year and then a couple years of control beyond that, about to turn 28. What is the asset cost on a Reynolds? I'd imagine Pittsburgh isn't, like Ben said, as interested in a catcher maybe as St. Louis is. Does it cost you a high-end arm from the system? Is it a little lower than that? I guess what I'm trying to get to here is, you know, let's say a Reynolds deal and a Nootbaar deal are both on the table. What is the more affordable in terms of prospect cost or asset cost for Toronto?
I think Nootbaar would be just because the Cardinals want what the Jays have in surplus. I don't see the Pirates taking a young catcher, I guess, unless they were really ready to move Moreno. But to your point, they've already got Henry Davis coming, and I don't see that. So for me, the asset that the Jays are most willing to give up that has legitimate value right now is a catcher. And the Pirates don't seem to want that. And so the Cardinals want what the Jays have to offer. Meanwhile, with respect to the Pirates, they'd be wanting high-end, minor league, close to the majors type talent. You know, is that Aurelvis Martinez? Is it potentially one of the arms at the top level? Those I think are the big questions there. Is it Tiedemann? I would have I'll say this, and I'm pretty comfortable in this assessment. I would have a hard time imagining the Jays could get Brian Reynolds without giving up either Ricky Tiedemann or Aurelvis Martinez in that trade. I don't see a path for the Jays to give up bulk of prospects not named Tiedemann or Martinez and be able to successfully outbid the rest of the industry to get Brian Reynolds, especially at a time when the Yankees could be involved there, the Rockies are one more team. I just think they're going to have to really step up, and I think stepping up, if you're the Jays, means Tiedemann or Martinez.
And Lars Nootbaar is a better name anyways, so I think they should be
leading. Lars Nootbaar is one of the great names. Of course, a Dutch name, I believe. I wonder if he'd be able to play for Team Netherlands there in the World Baseball Classic. That'd be pretty good. I said before the tournament began, before the World Cup, I said the team that's got the best chance to go deep in both the World Cup and the World Baseball Classic is the Netherlands, and I am afraid and sort of sad that I was correct there, that the Americans were knocked out there in the round of 16.
Well, it's a level further than the Canadians got, so congratulations to them. But yeah,
but you guys are back in the dance. You're back in the dance. That's the key thing.
We are. We're back. Another name that's been heavily linked to the Blue Jays, Andrew Haney, and our guy Ben Nicholson-Smith again reporting that the Blue Jays have actually formalized an offer towards Haney. There's also this report that everybody likes Andrew Haney, like a lot, like 10 teams. That's a third of the league. What are you hearing on Haney?
He's a very popular guy because that is the class of pitcher who is there, who's very appealing. I think you look at what Matthew Boyd, the former Jay, got from the Tigers there in his one-year deal, and that, I think, set the bar at a very high place for these sort of tweener-type pitchers, someone who's not going to give you 200 innings, someone who might be, at times, a reliever for you, a long guy. I think Tyler Anderson really set a tremendous standard for these pitchers who go to the Dodgers, figure some things out, and then move out into the market and do well. And, of course, Anderson went down the coast and is going to pitch for the Angels now. But this just reiterates to me how good the Dodgers are at taking a pitcher who's got stuff but maybe has not lived up to what they've got repertoire-wise, and finds a way to get the very best out of them. It's just, they are so darn good at that. And yet, they still now need to find the next Andrew Heaney or the next Tyler Anderson, and who knows, maybe it would still be the current Andrew Heaney that's the answer to that question for the Dodgers. But I look at Heaney's market, it's somewhat similar to maybe what Michael Wacha's market's going to be. Jameson Taillon's better, probably, but Noah Syndergaard might be in that same conversation because Syndergaard was a bit of an injury risk in the same way that Heaney is. So, guys, I think Heaney is a good fit for the Jays. And that to me, you know, we talked about Senga earlier. I think Senga is a great fit for the Jays if they can get him, and if it's the right contract and right situation. But if the Jays are going to hope that Kikuchi gives them something, then maybe and that Mitch White can give them half a season of quality, whether it's the first half or the second half or somewhere in the middle, that sort of filling out your rotation with a guy like Heaney has a lot of value because he can kind of bounce back and forth and fill different roles. But this still, guys, I have to keep making this point that they still have to add Heaney or Stripling or somebody like them just to get back to being where they were at the end of the season, because Stripling saved them so many times. And I'm just a big believer in what Ross did for that staff. And if they just kind of let him go and not worry about who he is on and off the field to replace, I think it's going to be a big mistake. He didn't grab the biggest headlines, but, man, he was crucial to that team. And Heaney, I think, would bring some of those same qualities to at least bring the Jays back at the end of the year to being as good as they were when the season was going on.
Well, how's this, John? If Kodai Senga and Lars Nootbaar don't end up as teammates on the Toronto Blue Jays, according to a Japanese newspaper in Los Angeles, Lars Nootbaar is actually going to play in the World Baseball Classic for Japan. So maybe they'll be teammates there. Lars Nootbaar's mother is Japanese. So there you go. Maybe there will be a connection there one way or another.
I love it. I did not know that about Lars. And when I'm on the air tomorrow, we have actually World Baseball Classic Media Day. I will speak with the leadership of Team Japan to make sure I get confirmation on Lars Nootbaar's participation.
All right, you are the go-to source for everything World Baseball Classic. So yeah, if we can bring you a new piece of information, that is quite something. I don't think it's ever happened.
And by the way, favorite month. I've got the winter meetings this week, and I've got the World Junior Camp there for Team USA next week. And I've been watching closely Adam Fantilli. Goodness, guys, all I can say is if he's not the number one pick, I don't know, guys. He's pretty good. That's all I'm going to say. I watch him play all the time. He's a pretty good hockey player.
And there you go. We just hit John Morosi bingo. Well done, everybody. John, always great. Enjoy California.
All the best, guys. Thanks for the conversation.
See ya. This is John Morosi, MLB Network. Lars Nootbaar, yes, father is like has some Dutch heritage naturally, mm-hmm. but yeah, Japanese mother playing for Team Japan.
Yeah, the reports out of this is a Los Angeles a Japanese newspaper that circulates in Los Angeles. Both Nootbaar and Stephen Kwan expected to suit up for
nice.
Japan.
Nice. That's sweet.
All we know on the Canada side is, back in July, Freddie Freeman said he'd be down to do it again.
Yeah.
All right.
Feels like kind of a fallow period for like high level Canadian baseball players. The NBA is doing well, but yeah, it's like Tyler O'Neill, a bit of a step back this past season.
Vlad, though.
Yeah, he doesn't play for Canada.
I know.
He could. So back to the trade discussion, because I think that's interesting. Like, if you're a Blue Jays fan, who would you rather trade for? Would you rather trade for Lars Nootbaar and the incredible name? Left-handed hitter with incredible patience, perhaps not the power of a Brian Reynolds. And the defense is a bit of a head-scratcher because it doesn't play a lot of center field, right? Like, that was Carlson's deal, was playing center field. And Brian Reynolds has, but very poorly, at least last year. But 2 years ago, like, I was like an MVP candidate.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough comparison defensively. I think what it comes down to in terms of, really, it comes down to Nootbaar's a little younger with more control. And I know a fan level, maybe you don't care about that. We know this front office cares about that. They talk about it all the time. But again, it's kind of, do you care more about the process or the results? And what do you make of bad process? Because Nootbaar is the, does everything right at the plate, makes all the right swing decisions, etc., and comes out with the exact same stat line as Brian Reynolds, who does not do the right things, but is so talented that it comes out in the wash a little bit. The big thing is, like, I think almost certainly I would rather trade Danny Jansen for Lars Nootbaar than Ricky Tiedemann for Brian Reynolds. If it's Aurelvis Martinez, maybe I can get there a little bit more.
Yeah. Ricky still hit 30 home runs in the minor leagues, which is a lot.
Sub 300 OBP.
So what? But that's what this team loves.
And he's really young still.
Yes, he is. Yeah, no, I think to me that's the big deciding factor, right? Like, if I think I might be leaning more Nootbaar anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you throw in the factor that you can, I mean, if that's the going rate for a Lars Nootbaar, is it Danny Jansen? I know that.
Like, I'll tell you this. If that deal is available to the Blue Jays front office right now, they should click accept.
I agree. It is. I think you do have to add another catcher into your organization if that's the case, right?
For sure.
If you're going into a window of contention season with Gabriel Moreno and Alejandro Kirk as your only two catchers, I think that's a problem. And it might be a problem if those are, like, I might not even be talking about a catcher like in AAA. Like, I might be of the opinion that you carry three catchers at least to start the season. And we also know about Kirk's, you know, his power does dissolve a little bit the more catching he does, and as good a receiver as he is, and especially with like what we expect maybe to be an uptick in at stolen base attempts next season, like Gabriel Moreno's pop time being incredible. Yeah, I think Like, there is an aspect of the Danny Jansen thing that we shouldn't just overlook, right? Because he brings more to the table than just his baseball reference page / numbers.
Definitely. And this is where the catcher situation, you know, maybe you start to look at someone who has some additional flexibility there. When we were talking about Dalton Varsho, that was something that was attractive to me.
If
you give up a catcher in that deal, Varsho then becomes your third catcher because he's played it as recently as last year. Maybe you go the free agent route. There are, you know, it's not a sexy catcher market. That's why the Jays have so much leverage on the trade front. We're going to see Christian Vasquez get a pretty good deal somewhere, I'd imagine. But yeah, maybe then you take a swing at one of those kind of 35-year-old defense first catchers who aren't going to play a lot. Sadly, our guy Luke Maley's already been scooped up by Cincinnati.
He's great. Just in all ways. A great interview as well.
Mm-hmm. Got a future.
Yeah.
Got a future.
As most catchers
so
do.
So we'll see how the architects of the Toronto Blue Jays continue through the winter meetings here. You can also see the architect, Seth Rollins, because the WWE Holiday Tour is coming to Toronto at Coca-Cola Coliseum on December 30th. We want to give you and a friend the chance to go see this live event. All you have to do is listen for the code word, text it in to 590-590. I made that segue with intention. Today's code word is Rollins, as in Seth freaking Rollins, the architect, the visionary. You can text Rollins right now to 590-590 for your chance to win a pair of tickets to this amazing event. We're giving away another pair of tickets tomorrow and Wednesday, so be sure to tune in. There'll be different code words, though. So what will my segue be? What will I shoehorn a wrestling reference to tomorrow? Today, it's Rollins.
And that what you did that effortlessly. We'll see if it's as effortless tomorrow.
I haven't looked yet at what the code word is for tomorrow. So I
don't do it. Do it on the fly tomorrow. I want to see if it works out. I'm excited.
All right. All right. I wonder if one of them will be a Bray Wyatt related one.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Bring up your son.
Yeah. I don't know how you're going to segue that one, but yeah, again, tune in tomorrow to find out. Raptors against the beasts of not just the East, but all of the NBA tonight. The Boston Celtics are good on paper. They're good in reality. And the Raptors get to see them for the first time this season tonight. We'll talk about that. And plenty more next as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Ben Ennis, Blake Murphy. So if you were listening on Friday, you know that Blake had to depart after the first segment to do his television duties, as Sportsnet had the broadcast, the Raptors and Brooklyn Nets, after the Raptors got their clocks cleaned by the Pelicans on Wednesday of last week. Thought, you know, be a better start to Friday's game. Certainly wouldn't give up 40 points in the first. They did it again. And they got destroyed in back-to-back games. They haven't lost three in a row this season because they got the Magic on Saturday. They got a bunch of the Magic coming up. But yeah, the Friday performance prompted Fred VanVleet to say, "We suck right now." And it was hard to disagree with that assessment of this team. They had like a players-only meeting. I mean, it's debatable what how you want to categorize it. But yeah, there were certainly some words exchanged amongst the leadership group on this Raptors team. And I guess it worked because they beat the hapless Magic on Saturday.
They sure did. They sure beat the hapless Magic. Now, that Friday game against Brooklyn was very disappointing to come out that flat again. And yeah, Brooklyn's a really good team. They've been awesome offensively of late. Absolutely no excuse for giving up 41 and a quarter, having nothing offensively, and having a lot of poor individual performances. I guess cool that you did your fake comeback thing that you've been known for a couple years, but it's probably time to stop being one of the worst first quarter teams in basketball and always playing from behind, because that's exhausting. It's difficult. It forces you to ratchet up the aggression on a strategy that already kind of teeters on the edge of how aggressive you can safely get. with respect to what you give up on defense. Now, there were some positives. I thought Scotty Barnes had a better game in that one, despite the turnover problems. I thought Scotty Barnes built on that on Saturday with a good game against Orlando. OG Anunoby was tremendous across those two games. But the Raptors are going through it right now, and Fred VanVleet wearing it as he did, taking not only ownership for the team not playing well, but when asked about the performance of Scotty Barnes or anyone really, he continues to put it back on himself because he's going through it right now as well. He's not a guy that has had Philadelphia 76ers series aside in the championship run. Fred VanVleet is not a guy who slumps very often. When I was pulling the numbers for that Friday hit on TV, one of the most astounding things was he almost never goes 0-for from three in a game. And if he does, it's almost an immediate bounce back. But he's in a stretch right now where he is 1 for his last 22 on threes, and the rest of his game, the defense has still been there for the most part, but he is going through it right now. So we'll see tonight. Boston is
really good.
Yeah.
So there's only six NBA players who are averaging at least 27 points per game and 7 rebounds per game. Two of them reside on the same team. That would be Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, who are both very good.
Do you want an even better way to contextualize how good they are?
Okay.
Right now, they own the best offense in NBA history.
Yeah, that's good.
It's not... It falls off of number one. John Schumann of NBA.com pointed this out today. If you control for the league scoring environment, so the basketball version of an OPS plus or something like that, they are slightly not the best offense of all time. Mm. But in terms of raw points per possession, nobody has ever scored at this level. And we're 24 games into the season. This isn't you had the best offense over five games to start the year. This is you have a remarkably good offense over more than a quarter of a season, almost a third of a season now. And there's almost nothing they're not doing well. They're first in effective field goal percentage. So that's field goal percentage that adjusts for the extra value of threes. They're first by a comfortable margin in that. They don't really turn the ball over, which is notable against a team like the Raptors that needs that transition offense to thrive. And they go to the free throw line a lot because they're very hard to defend. On top of all that, they're an above average defense too. So
yeah, defensive rating. I saw they were about middle of the pack.
Yeah, the 12th.
Yeah. But yeah, offensive ratings quite good.
The odds, best of all time.
Yeah. Like you said, they're like across the board. I mean, betting favorites to win it all. They were a team that was just in an NBA finals a season ago. Of course, different head coach at the helm, but that doesn't seem to be slowing them down. Jason Tatum is tied for the best odds to be NBA MVP. They're really, really good. And then they added Malcolm Brogdon, who the Raptors, I guess, were maybe runners-up for his services as he dictated terms in his trade from Indiana and decided he wanted to go to the team that was further along. And it's really, I mean, it was hard to argue with his case at the time, and certainly even harder now that he's a part of the best offense in the history of the sport, and he's part of it. He's shooting 49% from three, which leads the NBA.
Luckily for the Raptors.
Okay.
Unfortunately for basketball fans, Malcolm Brogdon is out tonight.
Oh.
Al Horford also out. They're on the second night of a back-to-back, so they're handling things closely. Marcus Smart sat out yesterday. He'll play today against the Raptors. So no Brogdon in this one, but it is pretty telling to look back at, and this is what Raptors fans do. Like, the quote comes out from Malcolm Brogdon that, Indiana consulted me on where I might want to go. We don't know what Toronto offered. We don't know anything like that. Like, Boston didn't give up really any player equity in that trade. It was just, here's a bunch of salaries to match, but it was also two first round picks. Mm-hmm. And maybe the Raptors were more, hey, here's a player. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But yeah, of course, Raptors fans are going to glob onto that. And then the Celtics are this good. And I hate to say this. Not only are they good, they're so fun.
Yeah, they're fun. I mean, and more fun, I suppose. I mean, Marcus Smart is fun in a different way, but no Marcus Smart makes them a little bit more tolerable from an opposing fan perspective.
Sure. Raptors fans.
Yeah, he's Kyle Lowry. I know that's what you're going to do, right? You're going to do the Kyle Lowry thing?
He's not Kyle Lowry offensively, but you can't be mad at Marcus Smart having rooted for Kyle Lowry and then Fred VanVleet. Not that Fred VanVleet's as pesty, but the in your jersey defense, and you know, Kyle Lowry also had the ref discussions and things like that. Marcus Smart now probably the guard king when it comes to drawing charges too.
So, yeah, you mentioned they're coming off back-to-back. They beat that Nets team in Brooklyn yesterday, the Boston Celtics. Now, what would you say is the Raptors' signature win this season? Because they had that great win against the Mavs despite being shorthanded. They had an early win against the Sixers, I want to say. I mean, this is the first time they've really played. I mean, again, maybe the Sixers, maybe the Nets are really that upper echelon championship contender early in the season. And you're right, the Nets have turned it around, especially offensively recently. And they're not fully healthy either because Ben Simmons is out. Might be a huge factor in that. Haven't played the Bucks, have not played the Celtics. And not that this team like only gets up for certain opponents, because they're in no way like along the line of development to ever have that type of thought process. And if they were, like, Friday would have been a pretty good opportunity to do that against a Nets team that you're already 0-2 against this season, and they came out and stubbed their toe, like, their toe was in pieces at the conclusion of the first quarter in that game. But this is it, man. Like, you want to change the narrative of basically this entire slump? You want to put yourself, you want to make me look like not a complete idiot who said that you were the third best team in the Eastern Conference, and then you went out and got waxed in consecutive games? Tonight would be a good start for that.
Because guess what it's going to look like if not? You have the Celtics and then the Lakers here later this week. And yeah, the Lakers are not good, but they have LeBron and Anthony Davis. It's entirely possible for them to beat anyone on a given night. And then you play the Magic twice more, and then your schedule gets difficult again. It's possible you're looking at this close to Christmas, and your only wins recently have come against like Orlando and Sacramento, where you've lost to, you've got Brooklyn again on the schedule, Golden State's here in a couple weeks, the Lakers, Celtics. It could not look great, and that can be tough for confidence heading into the second half of the season, heading into the trade deadline where this team has some tough decisions to make for sure. In terms of what that signature win is, I honestly think it's the season opener against Cleveland.
That was a good one.
Because Cleveland was so good after that. The Philly one's a good one too, but they almost erased it with like, you had this amazing win against Philadelphia and then Joel Embiid missed the next game and you got beat up.
Yeah.
Like, it was not even competitive. So no. It almost undercut it. Yeah, you could use a marquee win and doing it here against Boston. And yeah, there will be the caveat of back-to-back and no Brogdon, no Horford. But when we talked earlier in the season about how hard the Raptors schedule was to start, part of that discussion was, well, you have all these rest advantages coming up. The schedule balances out eventually. You got to take advantage of that. And we've already seen the Raptors punt that a couple of times. Yeah, they got that Cavs win in part because the Cavs were on a back-to-back and had been really beaten up the game prior to that one. We're dealing with illnesses and stuff, but you got to take advantage of spots like this where ideally you're measuring yourself against Boston. Mm-hmm. You're not even in a spot to measure yourself against Boston right now. You have to just steal a win against Boston when they're not 100%, and then maybe next meeting you can measure yourself against Boston.
Yeah, you can. Raptors haven't played the Warriors yet either. They've kind of righted themselves after a really, really slow start to the season. They're back over 500.
They're going to be fine.
They're going to be fine. This video of Steph Curry hitting 5 full court shots in a row is going around social media. And obviously he's going to hit 5 full court shots in a row. He hits them. I mean, his warm-up routine is literally shooting from the tunnel, right? And he makes those quite often. But I do want... I mean, some of the locations that Steph Curry hit shots are now just like, that's just part of the game, right? He did more to change the sport of basketball than maybe anyone in its recent history, right? Like, pulling up from the logo was not only not a thing, it would, like, you would have to be, you would be benched immediately, you'd be shunned from society, and you'd have to go live in the woods if you took a shot like that 25 years ago. Like, how accurate would he have to be to, like, start taking shots from his side of half court? Because there is, like, there would be an advantage, right, to forcing the opposition to come out and press, like, the length of the court on defense, every single defensive possession to play defense the full length of the court or something close to it. Like, at what point, how efficient would Steph Curry have to be for you to think about letting him expand his range even more than it's already expanded?
The honest answer is it's Steph Curry. He can shoot from anywhere, and I don't care.
Honestly, if he did that in a game.
More statistically, so you're right that Steph Curry has changed the game a ton because obviously LeBron is one of the greatest players of all time in an argument for greatest player of all time. But what has made LeBron so successful is not something that can be replicated by system or by, you know, work like trying stuff on a court. Steph Curry was born to one of the best shooters in NBA history as well. So it's not as if his is entirely self-made, just shooting in the gym. But there is an element of what Steph Curry does, other people can maybe approximate, and you can try to approximate it from a system standpoint. And the way Steph has changed the game is the geometry of it is we hit a point with the three-point revolution where everyone knew the corners were the most efficient spot to shoot from. And there's no way to change that unless you eliminate corner threes or widen the floor. So if you're an offense, what's the next step? Because eventually defenses are going to catch up and they're going to treat the corners as a high efficiency spot. And what guys like Steph Curry and to a lesser extent, Damian Lillard, Kyrie Irving, guys like that. And it's part of what made Kyle Lowry so valuable. Even though he wasn't a 3-point shooter at the level of those guys, he could pull up from 30. That stretches the floor vertically. And because horizontally, we had figured it out.
Yeah.
Now a defense, you have to cover more vertically as well. And that's where you see teams. Now, I don't know if anyone would ever pick up any shooter full court.
Well, what if he started, like, what if he like went 2 for 2? Like you inbound the ball and he's chucking it from his own corner.
Right. And go back and watch the NBA finals when the Raptors were against Steph Curry. Yeah. They had a lot of injuries, so you could overload on him more, but Fred VanVleet was picking him up at the shallowest at half court. And that was, if you cross half court, I'm in your jersey because you are capable of, like, half court is 47 feet and he will pull up from 35.
Yeah.
He has hit a 35 footer this year. He has hit a bunch of 31 and 32 footers this year. And that is kind of what Steph Curry has done to change the game. Not everyone's going to shoot 44% on an impossibly difficult diet of threes when everyone in the arena knows you're going to take those. But guys can at least stretch the range out from, you know, a guy who maybe only had permission to shoot from the hash mark before on the wing there can now shoot from the top or can shoot a little deeper in transition, because that's the only way, with everyone being larger, everyone being faster, and everyone knowing that rim is the priority, corner is the second priority. The only way to break a defense now or force them into tougher things is to stretch it out vertically.
Well, so is the benefit of taking it, because they're all worth 3 points, right? Unless you start making the full court shot worth 5, then obviously, yeah, you should be taking it more. But like, if it's only worth 3, like, yeah, you have to find some reason to take it. And it would be that, I guess, you would force the defense into working harder, right? Because they would have to, they'd basically be playing a press the entire game.
It's not only the work harder part. It's, think of when Steph Curry gets a screen from Draymond Green, for example, up. And the Warriors will do this, and this was one of their adjustments against the Raptors, is the further up the court you pick up Steph Curry, the further up the court they'll set that first screen. Because right, if you try to trap that screen or double Steph Curry to get the ball out of his hands, then you have, like, if you do the pick and roll at the free throw line, say, and Steph Curry makes that pocket pass to Draymond Green, that's not a ton of space to take advantage of the 4-on-3 underneath the trap. If you do that up at the logo, then you've got a whole half court,
right,
where you're playing 4-on-3.
Or in this scenario, the entire court.
Yes. And you have, like, Klay Thompson is right there. Jordan, yeah, Poole is right there. Andrew, yeah, Wiggins is right there.
So am I onto something?
Well, there is a limit of, like, a defense just isn't going to come out to the full court
unless he, like, if he, because he's gonna, at the first time he ever took this, he would be wide open, right? Like, wide open.
Yeah.
And what if he made it? Because he, like, clearly he picks up a ball, first shot he makes it, second shot he makes it, third shot, fourth shot, fifth shot, he makes them all.
I, right, will say this, with big men in pick and pop or like trailing and transition and stuff like that, teams don't really bend on that, like how they cover that. Like, part of the Milwaukee Bucks defensive strategy over the years has been, if you are a big man and you want to pick and pop or you're trailing in transition, they will let you shoot those threes all day. Threes are efficient, yes, but most big guys are only going to shoot about 35% on those. That's 1.05 points per possession. Mm. The Celtics are scoring over 1.2 points per possession right now. There are more efficient things on the floor for you to take care of than a big man being open for the top three. So if they're willing to concede that at 35%, and that's a much closer three, and Steph Curry had to establish himself as not only the greatest shooter of all time, but, hey, I can probably hit these 35-footers at like a 35% clip before teams started doing that, I think you'd have to be like in the 33% range before teams even start like really considering it. Because 33%, that's an incredible rate for like a three-quarter court or a half-court shot. But you're only talking about a point of possession. That's an inefficient possession.
Right.
And even if you're wide open, you're probably only hitting those, like, I don't know, one out of three at game speed?
I don't know. But, I mean, you say game speed, but yeah, again, first one is just like he did it in the gym. And I guess he's, like, got a sweat on. I would just like to see it. I mean, imagine, yeah, what it would look like.
I would love to see it, too.
Yeah, in a game, maybe a blowout, although, you know, the talking heads, they might explode.
In a blowout, you're probably risking a
Coach K would be freaking out wherever he is.
Someone else on your team is taking a hard foul at the rim later in that game if you are up 30 and pulling up from half court with 22 seconds on the shot clock.
No, again, not a half court, full court. All right, I want to get this in before we go, but Fred McGriff is going to the Hall of Fame. Not drafted by the Blue Jays, but the Blue Jays acquiring him before his major league debut from the New York Yankees. Great slugger, almost 500 home runs. Would have had it if not for the strike-shortened 1994 season. But I think most Blue Jays fans know him as the key part of the biggest trade in this franchise's history, and that he and Tony Fernandez going to San Diego for Joe Carter and Roberto Alomar, and then the Blue Jays subsequently winning back-to-back World Series titles, as if you needed to be reminded of that. But I think secondarily from that, it's pretty indicative that this new era committee, which meets every 3 years, they ain't into the steroid guys. Yeah, the Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, they needed 12 of the 16 members to vote for them. They got four at most. Or at most four. So
Is not even as many as new Blue Jays bench coach Don Mattingly, correct?
Yes, and Don Mattingly. So there's a couple of, yeah. Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens were up over 60% when they fell off the media ballot. The new era didn't like them as much as even the writers did. Curt Schilling, same deal. Curt Schilling was like 14 votes or something away from being inducted on the media side, but they didn't like him so much either. He only got seven votes, seven of the 16. And Don Mattingly, his vote percentage, I don't have it in front of me, but I know he, I think, capped at 20% amongst the media, and it was at least 10% more than that.
Jay's adjacent Fred McGriff to the Hall of Fame question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Does this make you feel more or not more confident that Carlos Delgado will eventually get in? 473 career home runs, also a first baseman, also one of the guys held up by that era of media as one of the guys who there was never a suggestion or evidence that he was not on the up and up.
I hope that's the case. I mean, he played in a huge media market. It's not like he was, nobody knew who Carlos Delgado was when he was slugging homers for the New York Mets. I do wonder if like that narrative of him not, he was an early not standing for the anthem guy and that eventually came around. But I wonder if there's some media narrative that might hurt him in that regard.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Those people.
Time now for Last Call, brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. Let's start with the Raptors and Celtics. And the Raptors find themselves actually favored against the best team in the NBA. But as you mentioned, without some of their best guys and playing on the back end of back-to-backs, Raptors on the money line, minus 122 favorites. And the spread is 1.5. Raptors, 1.5, -1.5 in this game. Scotty Barnes, the total 15.5 points for him. Pascal Siakam, 24.5. Fred VanVleet, 6.5 assists is the total for him, and the Celtics paying plus 400 to win the NBA title this season. And Monday Night Football, Buccaneers hosting the Saints, Bucks -3.5 at home. And that was Last Call, brought to you by Bet Rivers. it's a whole new game. We'll be back tomorrow. Blake Murphy, Ben Ennis, Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.